Hello and welcome to Developing Perspective. This is the second in the interview series that I'm doing here on Developing Perspective, where I sit down with an interesting iOS or Mac developer and talk about their experiences, some of the lessons they've learned, how they work productively, and hopefully help us all kind of learn and get better at our development as a result. These interviews are longer than 15 minutes, so a little bit of a break from the normal pattern on the show. I try and keep them under an hour, but I just want to let you know that ahead of time. Otherwise, I hope you'll enjoy, sit back, and today I have Bill Dudney with me. All right, it's my pleasure to introduce Bill Dudney of many things, and I'll go ahead and, Bill, introduce yourself, so sure. Say what you're doing, where you, what kind of work you do.
Sure. So my name is Bill Dudney, and I've done a whole bunch of seemingly random stuff, starting back in college when I first touched my first Next computer in, I think it was 89 on system .9, which was really cool. It was a lot of fun. I did a bunch of Objective-C and did much worse in school the semester I bought my Next computer. And so that led to a whole bunch of Next Step stuff until 97. I got into Java, did that for a while, and then decided I was fed up with the whole IT space and got back into the Mac. And I was building a Mac app when the iPhone first came out. And my wife built a couple of web apps for the initial iPhone.
Okay.
And they did amazing. We had a bazillion plays on the games that she wrote and made a bunch of money off of Google Ads, which was crazy. Like, who makes money off of Google Ads on iPhone games? So then when the SDK was announced, I decided it was time to stop messing around with the Mac app I was writing and go build the apps that she did that were the most popular in web technologies, to rebuild them in native technology. So I did that, and then at the same time, I had gotten involved with the Prags writing the iPhone SDK book right after I finished the core animation book. And so then I finished that book up, and then since then I've written, I don't know, probably another four or five apps for both iPhone and iPad, and then many of those have been mine, and done a couple for clients, and teaching at the iPhone Studio, or iOS Studio as it's known now, for Pragmatic Programmers and Pragmatic Studio, and so a lot of random stuff, speaking at conferences and teaching people all over the place. So,
and a brief stint working in the mothership?
Yes, it was a blast. I loved Apple. It was a very cool place, but it was hard to be away from the mountains, and I really missed being able to teach. I didn't think that it would affect me as much as it did, but it was really hard being inside Apple, where I couldn't blog about Objective-C, or I couldn't talk about iPhone SDK or whatever with people outside, because everybody always thought, even if I was just saying something random that I thought was interesting, I didn't want that ending up on Mac Rumors, right?
Sure.
So I had to button my lip and not talk about it when I was outside of work, and that part was frustrating. And then again, you know, like I was telling you earlier about teaching, it just, I love, like, standing in front of a group of people and saying, you know, whatever, blah, 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 this cool thing about iPhone, and then go and watch what cool stuff they come up with, and, you know, watch the light bulb turn on and stuff like that. That's just a blast, and I love doing that, and I really missed it, so, and I missed the mountains, so it was hard to be in California and not in Colorado.
Okay. Cool. So speaking of Colorado, so that's where you're right now, in Breckenridge, right?
Yep.
I was wondering if you can kind of paint the picture of when you go to sit down to work, when you're wanting to be productive, whether that's writing for your book or working on apps for yourself or for clients. What does that environment look like when you really want to get to it?
Yeah. So my most productive time, what I try to do is I'm an early riser, so I get out of bed 4:30. I spend a half an hour sort of getting caught up on what happened the previous day. I read a couple of blogs and, you know, look at stuff on the net and whatever. And then by 5 a.m., I have my coffee brewed and I'm sitting in front of my computer, and it's usually dark because, you know, at 5 in the morning it's dark or whatever. I like the room to be dark. I keep all the shades closed even during the day when it's bright outside. And I, you know, just sort of, that's the time after that half hour of sort of waking up and drinking my first cup of coffee. That's when I get in the zone. And then I'll usually work for about 2.5 to 3 hours till around 8 o'clock, when the family's awake and everybody's ready to eat breakfast or has already eaten breakfast. Then I'll go over, spend 15 minutes with my family or whatever, saying good morning. And then I come back and I get back to work. And again, that takes about 15 minutes after that's over to get back in the zone. But that's how I get there, is, you know, sort of have the room dark and quiet and just sit in front of my iMac and have the brightness of the computer illuminate the room, but that's about it.
Okay.
So you're so you run an iMac? Are you a, yes. a single monitor kind of person?
So I have two monitors, and I usually keep design-oriented stuff on one monitor and then Xcode on another monitor.
Okay.
I try to keep email like hidden or quit for a couple of hours at a time. Although sometimes when there's stuff cooking with clients or whatever, I definitely have email going so I can respond right away. But I find that to be really distracting, you know, and the email things beep and you got a 4 unread messages. I start getting nervous and scratching my chin and fighting the urge to check, you know, to make sure nothing's going on or whatever. But yeah.
Yeah. 4 is, I think, like any number below 5 is the worst because I find, at least for myself, it's if you have... Like every now and then you see a, like someone does a screenshot of their computer and you'll see it's like 200 or 300 unread messages or whatever.
Right.
At that point it doesn't matter.
Exactly. It could be 4,000, right? Yeah. You just whatever.
It just doesn't matter. But when you for you know like if you only have 4 or 5, then I find that that's or 1 is even worse.
Yeah.
What is that? What is, I know what it is. It's one. It's one thing right there.
It's very hard to not look at that. Yeah. Yeah. So if I have it quit and it's, you know, it's gone, then I find it, you know, it doesn't distract me. But I also have to have my phone somewhere sitting on a cloth so that when it vibrates when the mail comes in, it doesn't make me think, should I launch mail? I think I'll go launch mail and make sure that's not something important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so in terms of other than Xcode, what tools and apps and things on your computer do you typically use when you're working?
So I always have to have some sort of, when I'm writing, I have some sort of text editor. I've been using TextMate. I've been playing with, the free BB Edit thing and then even just TextEdit, to edit XML or Markdown stuff or whatever, for stuff that I'm writing. When I'm working on the book or a book for Prague, I'm usually writing in XML, and a lot of people complain about that, but I don't really find it to be that distracting. I guess it's sort of like I have the 4 or 5 tags or whatever that I use all the time.
Sure.
So it doesn't really get in the way for me. Some people, it drives them nuts, and they can't ever like get over the hump of being able to just use those 4 or 5 that they use all the time. Yes, and that's either TextMate or... I think it's called Text Wranglers from the same people who make BB Edit.
So you're editing that just in a regular, just a raw text editor with syntax highlighting and all that.
Yep, exactly. And so, I mean, the bulk of what goes into a book is text, right? And so there's only a little bit of markup around, you know, this is a class name or this is an Objective-C method name or whatever. So I find I'm using those 4 or 5 tags, paragraph, Objective-C method, and class name a lot, and the rest of them... You know, there's a ton of flexibility in there in terms of how you can organize stuff and tag it and everything. But, yeah. Other tools that I use, I use OmniGraffle a lot to draw pictures, and I do that for both. So when I'm doing either training for Pragmatic Studio or I'm doing public speaking at conferences like CocoConf or whatever, a lot of what I try to do with my presentations is be very visual. I hate... going to presentations where there's 1,000 words on the screen, and I hate sitting through those, and I don't want to make presentations like that. So I'm typically doing something very visual. It's either, you know, a screenshot of something going on the screen, or it's a OmniGraffle drawing or whatever. So that's a tool that I use a lot for doing those things. Sometimes it's really helpful for me to use OmniGraffle to sort of sketch out an idea too. Like when I'm thinking about, especially if I need to conceptualize the classes of something, sometimes I'll draw pictures. You know, I hate UML. I used to be a big proponent back in the Java days of doing UML. So I try very hard not to do anything that's even remotely resembling UML. But what I'll do is drop a box, name it whatever, you know, some class name, and then write some notes about it, and then sort of use that to visualize the interconnections between the classes and how they're going to talk to each other and divide up the responsibilities and stuff.
Yeah, I always find that I just do that in Xcode. It's interesting because my approach for whenever I'm kind of if I want to sketch something out, I'll just do file new class just 10 times and kind of I don't know that I always think in code, I guess, and so like for me that's where I start playing with it is, and for me more often than not, once I've got a couple once you get your beachhead of like, okay, this seems to be working, and I'll just keep running in Xcode. So I find that, it's on a whiteboard. But.
Yeah. So I find sometimes I do that, and sometimes it's really productive for me to start in Xcode and creating new classes. What I find a lot of times is I'm most productive if I do that and then delete all that code, or at least push it aside and start over from scratch. Because what I'll do when I'm like new file, and I'm connecting these classes and just basically hacking to see how I think I want this thing to work, is I get to an idea where I'm like, aha, that's the way it ought to work. Oh, but I have all this garbage that I've created. Sure. I was creating some a relatively large XML parser that was taking XML and turning it into Objective-C objects, and then vice versa.
Sure.
And I must have written it three times. Because I wrote it the first time, like, oh, this is horrible. And then I started writing out in OmniGraph what I was going to do. It's like, oh, this is horrible, too. So I pitched that, and then I went back to code and created a whole bunch of code. Oh, this is all horrible, but if it did this, right? Mm-hmm. So it was like the third time was the charm. I talked to a lot of people who have a hard time pitching that code. They're like, oh, I just spent a week writing all that code. You know, but if you got to maintain it for 6 months, oh, I'd much rather pitch that week's worth of bad code and start over.
What kind of version control do you use? Because that's one thing that I've often, you always hear about, like, for example, Git or Mercurial or one of those. It's like, oh, the lightweight branching's great for that, exactly that kind of reason, where you're creating these experimental or thought branches rather than having it be actual, a big, heavy operation. Is that the kind of thing, way you do it, or are you just...
So, you know, I try to love Git, but it's like, how can we make the simple stuff as heinously complex as possible and then make the really difficult stuff possible? I hate that mentality. You know, like, I'm really glad that it's free and that it's open source, and I love GitHub because you can share stuff and whatever. Mm-hmm. I love that. I just find Git to be so insanely complex to do really simple stuff. You know, I'm working on a project with my son, and in order for us to share code, I have to commit. Oh, but wait, commit doesn't do it. I have to commit minus A. Oh, wait, I've got this other thing because he committed one file. Now I got to pull. Now I got to commit again. Now I can actually push it. And that just, it drives me up the wall. But the client wants that, wants it in Git. So, you know, whatever, I'll do it. It's just not my favorite. So I just use Subversion.
Okay.
Or I sometimes use Git, but it's behind the Xcode make a snapshot.
Sure.
Right? And so that makes it really simple to sort of revert. And if, I find if I'm doing a lot of hacking where I go down a thought branch and I pitch it, I want to, like, make a snapshot so that I keep that around, but it's not, you know, in the normal stack of stuff. So, and I guess I've heard that that uses Git behind the scenes. But I don't care, right? Because it's so simple. You just, oh, look, here's the list of snapshots. Yeah. It can get out of hand, and I wouldn't use that as my version control system because it's all flat and, right, just ends up in one long list. But just as a thought experiment thing, I like doing that because it's simple to do. It's so much simpler than, you know, Git. Push, commit, blah, 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 whatever, dance.
Oh, sure, I mean, I think Git, I've been using it for so long that I think it's just grown on me. It's sort of, I have the Stockholm syndrome of it now, like, is the problem, because it always feels a little heavy-handed for a lot of what it does, and I don't use Git, I think, in a way that, I read all these, like, you know, whatever, pro-Git or whatever, or Git flow, all these, like, methodologies and things where you have, like, 27 branches for all, like, anytime you start a new concept, you create a branch for it and all this. And for me, I've always found that to be so... It's like I'm spending all this time and work building something that that isn't actually work.
Right.
It's like I'm just playing around outside of my actual job and what I'm trying to do.
Right.
And so, like, the only closest thing to that I ever do with Git is... one thing I love is that you can branch after you've made a bunch of changes without... rather than having to do it ahead of time. Because that's like, that whole concept blows my mind, where I'm like, I think I'm going to do something experimental, so I'm going to make a branch. That's never how my mind works. I think about, I think about the problem I'm working on, and I'm just working on the problem. And I'm not really cognizant that halfway through that, I went in this crazy experimental direction, more often than not.
Right.
And so what I love is that you can be developing on whatever branch you're on, and then you can take your working copy and just say, okay, this maybe I shouldn't have done it this way. And you can just take that, put it off in a branch, and then just go back to where you were before. Which is something that I've only seen in like Subversion or something. It's much more difficult, at least in my experience, was to play with those kind of things. Well, like, to take your working copy and sort of stash it off somewhere.
Right. Yeah. But do you find yourself going back to those branches?
I find that what I typically end up doing is I'm going back to them to grab a method or to grab
a little snippet of code,
rather than necessarily. I think it's like what you were talking about before, where it's often you'll end up in order to arrive at the good solution, you end up having to drive through all these crazy twists and turns.
Right.
And often you'll have these tiny little nuggets in between that I actually want to keep. But I want to get rid of the bulk of that and just put those back into a good framework. And so that's what I'll end up doing. And
yeah, maybe I need to read ProGit or something, right? Because I don't...
I've never found those. I mean, I have almost all of my projects, I just have master. And then I have these little like stashes of code branching off the sides just to... It's like they're rather than having this... So sort of this broader process, and I've just right. I've never found maybe, and a lot of that too I think is because it's just like it's you have to have a different flow when you're working with a team of people like right. 5 or 6 people, and so I think we're both fairly similar in the sense that we're not doing these big corporate projects where it's like you and a team of 10 people and you have to have like a whole process, and you even have like often you'll have like the poor guy on the team whose job it is to manage the version control system, and right. like the guy who's doing the merges and builds, and I mean that's not a good
pain.
Job.
Yeah, pain. I guess some people are built that way, but it's not me.
Yeah. But yeah. Cool. So that's, and then in terms of, do you find you use different tools when you're doing? So like when you're if you're going to be working on code for one of your training things, and your book, and like you're doing all the source code, do you build that in a different way? Are using different things than you would if you're actually writing production code to
ship? And so what happens with that a lot is when you're teaching somebody something, a lot of times what you have to do is put aside the complexity that you know needs to be there in order to make it good code, in order to illustrate the point that you're trying to get across. So if you're trying to teach someone about, I don't know, NS arrays or whatever, you might do something in where you're trying to get someone to understand what an NS array is, especially if they're new to programming. And, you know, there'd be different things if it's someone new to programming versus someone who's an experienced programmer but's just trying to learn iOS. But if you're trying to teach someone NS array, for example, and sure. they don't know anything, you might approach NS array in a completely different way than you would already knowing how to do iOS programming and you're sort of in the culture of iOS. You want to bring people in slowly from a conceptual space of I don't know anything about programming and I've never broken down a problem into small pieces like that to get them to understand what an array is and how it holds a list of things and they're ordered and whatever, where you would never do that if someone was an experienced programmer and they're coming from Java or wherever and they already know what a list is in Java. You just need to help them translate from list to Java. So I find I build... more than probably the average iOS developer, I'm hitting Command Shift N and Xcode just all the time. Because in class, we build, I don't know, 15 different projects from scratch that we then end up at the end combining the ends of those 3 or 4 different trails into one big app where we take that stuff and reuse it and whatever. And so, you know, every time I teach a class, I create 15 or 20 projects. At home, every time I'm writing a new 1-hour presentation for CocoConf, or if I'm, you know, this, I'm doing a full day talk at SwipeConf in Australia in a month, talking about core graphics. That's another place. You know, I create a brand new project from scratch, and I do stuff in those new projects. That, as a new developer, how many times? I mean, as an experienced developer, you create one project and then you work on it for years.
Yeah.
Right. And so I do a lot of that stuff that's probably out of the norm for someone. But on my iMac, I'm always running Terminal and Xcode and TextMate, OmniGraffle most of the time, not always, but most of the time. And those are the three big things, Xcode and Terminal. And and I'm always, you know, doing stuff in Terminal. I tend to be, I don't know if it makes me a neckbeard or not, but I tend to trust the command line for subversion or get a lot more than I trust Xcode. And I don't know if that's just me being curmudgeonly or whatever, but I tend to do all that stuff through the command line instead of through the Xcode tools.
Yeah. Well, I've never used the Xcode tools for version control. I've been bitten by them a few too many times.
Yeah.
But what I find for Git especially is Git Tower. There's just an app called Tower for your, I think it's just called Tower actually, but it's just a Git client. I find what it does, the one thing that I like that it does, because Git is that weird two-phase commit where you stage and then actually commit, it makes that process much more obvious, especially tower. Coming from a subversion background.
Okay, well, I'll have to get that then.
Because I'm so used to, in a subversion background, we're just like, you just, like, SVN commit.
Right, and you're done.
If you've added new stuff, it adds it, and it reverses having to do this sort of selective, which can be great, but it's...
Yeah, right. It introduces a huge level of complexity that, you know, with subversion, I was used to...
Yeah.
Pleasantly ignoring that complexity. So.
So switching gears slightly, one of the things that I definitely wanted to talk to you about is, so you obviously do a lot of training and teaching for adults, for people who are coming to your classes or are going to conferences or those kinds of things. But I know also that your son's a developer and those kinds of things. And one thing I've always wondered about, as I have a son, he's 3 right now, so it's a little early probably, but I've always been thinking about how do you teach programming to kids, or I was curious how you've done that in terms of, as an educator, it's one of these things, like, in my mind, I have this dream of my, changing from, you know, like, my company to, like, Smith and Son, like, to but I've never quite, how do you actually start it?
Yeah, so my oldest is definitely, he's the kind of, he's got that personality where he wants to take everything apart and he wants to learn everything. And, it's phenomenally fun to work with him too. I've done 2 projects. I've done one project is completed. It's in the store and has lots of positive reviews and stuff. So it's really cool. And then another one we're working on right now together. And it is insanely fun working with him. If you can make it and sons, it's awesome. Or and daughters or whatever. Sure. Like, it's just, it's so much fun. But it's definitely a personality thing, I think, because we have a lot of kids and other kids, you know, he's now 15. I forced him, and he would say I forced him to go through the book called Learn to Program from Chris Pine, published by Pragmatic.
Okay.
Phenomenal book. It's focused on Ruby. So if you are definitely focused on iPhone, it might not be the right book if you want to learn how to program. For iPhone, but if you want to learn how to program, it's a fantastic book. So he finished it. This is like he was 10 or 11 years old, so it's 3, 4, or 5 years ago. When he finished it, I looked at his work, and he did all the right stuff. He'd get all the programming done, and he handed me the book, and he said, I never want to do this again. So, you know, I mean, it's a personality thing where my older son just ate it up, and he loved that kind of stuff. He was reading Stephen Cochran's Objective-C book when he was 11 and, you know, doing all sorts of crazy stuff. But to start with, the place he started was Lego Mindstorms, and I can't say enough good about Lego Mindstorms. They are so awesome, especially if your child is into Lego. Just so many cool things you can do on the mechanical side from building the robots, and then you can also go and program them using, they have a visual programming environment, which is a great place to start. Teaches you loops and branches and stuff like that. You know, drive forward for 5 feet, stop for 5 seconds, drive forward for 5 more feet, put on a sensor, a touch sensor, and if you feel a push on the touch sensor, then turn around, things like that.
So when you say visual programming, so that's sort of like you're dragging in components and wiring them up sort of physically rather than doing it in code.
And it looks like Legos, which is kind of cool. So you drag out a block that says if the touch sensor is hit, and then it has a branch on it, and that branch then says turn the motor to reverse for 5 seconds.
Okay.
That kind of stuff. And so you drag these blocks out, you connect them by drawing lines similar to the way you do an interface builder.
Sure.
And so they have like places where inputs come in and places where outputs go out. And so with that, then you can, the person can understand the basics of programming, branching and looping. And to a certain extent, variables, although it's not very focused on that necessarily. It would be like a sensor, and then that sensor has an output, and so it's kind of a variable, but you don't really get the feel for it. But from there, you can go, staying on Lego Mindstorms, building your robots, you can use something called Not Quite C, which is most of C, but it doesn't have a preprocessor and a couple of other things to simplify the compiler. And it will, I think it uses GCC behind the scenes. It compiles down to assembly language for the processor that's on the Lego Mindstorms. And it also has an environment that'll push it over the USB or IR port to the device, and then you can run your programs that you wrote in C. So that was part of the progression that that my oldest took, is he first did Lego Mindstorms with the visual programming. Then we got Not Quite C on it. And then at the time, I was really into Java in 2003 or something. And so we got, there was a Lajos Java VM that ran on it.
Okay.
And we went down the path of trying to make that work, but the tools on the Mac were not very good. And so we ended up abandoning that. But I think on the PC side, that that works. So you could, through a VM, you know, with Parallels or whatever, be able to do that. And then he spent a little bit of time with Squeak and Scratch, which are both Smalltalk-based environments from the MIT Media Lab. Both of those are really cool. And then from there, he just, one day he said, I want to write games. And he started studying OpenGL, and then that led him to linear algebra. And so, I mean, he's just, he's got that personality where he'll just rip apart everything, and he wants to understand stuff. We were talking the other day, and he said, you know, I really wish I had a time machine so I could go back in time and have enough time to learn everything. So it's definitely, it's a personality. It's personality thing. And I also did, so we homeschool, so we're part of a homeschool community in Breckenridge, and we did a class. A lot of people are asking, how did you get Andrew into programming and stuff, friends and stuff. And so we did a class with, like, I think we started off with 9 kids and we ended with 6. 3 of them had to drop out for various reasons, but we spent an entire year, once a week for 2 hours, we spent doing programming. And that was just complete basics. This is an array, this is an if statement, this is a for loop, and that kind of stuff. And, what that taught me was that every kid is different, and some kids are wired to do programming and some kids aren't. Not to say that they can't learn it, it's just some kids' personality style is they like to take things apart and figure out how they work and then see if they can put them back together. And some kids don't, right? Sure. I mean, you know this in adults too, right? You talk to some people and like, oh, awesome, I put gas in my car and I stick the key in the ignition and it runs.
That's all they want to know.
And other people are like, they're ripping apart their motor to find out, you know, how pistons work or whatever. So, and you know, kids are the same way. So it is interesting, and it's difficult to push. You can pull, but it's really difficult to push. And so it's you know, it's a fun adventure though. It's really cool watching, especially when you get the kids whose the light bulb goes on. They're you know, hacking at 2 o'clock in the morning, sending you emails and, hey, I tried to get this core animation thing to work and I couldn't, and this is my code. And
yeah, it's funny because I was thinking back to when, as you're talking, it's like I was trying to think how I got into it. And I think my first, the first time I ever did anything that would be considered programming was, I think, Logo? Is that what it was called?
Turtle? The Turtle,
I think it was on a Sinclair Spectrum.
Wow.
Which was, I mean, I have no idea when that was, like, I have no idea what age that was, but I just remember making the turtle go around.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And then it was BASIC on, like, the old Windows that shipped with, it was, like, I think it shipped with all Windows 3.
Yeah, way back there
was,
in the day.
It was QBASIC or
something like one of the BASIC derivatives.
And I just remember that was, and it's as from as early as I can remember, almost, it's like, I guess it is just like you have that aptitude for it, and it just stuck. You know, it's like, now that's how I make my living. That's kind of a crazy thing to think about. It started off with, you know, making turtles go around a screen to...
Isn't that crazy how that stuff unfolds? Yeah. My first was a Commodore 64, and I wrote this awesome, like, you remember, it wasn't Minecraft, no, it was Missile Command, right, where you had the things and you could,
like,
choose which base.
Kind of style?
There's incoming nukes, and you would shoot missiles from the ground.
Yeah,
okay, and I think it was called Missile Command.
I think that sounds right.
Anyway, so I had one that a balloon floated across the sky, and you had to shoot the balloon. I had a single missile base at the base.
Okay.
And so I spent hours and hours and hours till 2 or 3 in the morning writing this program, and I had it on a cassette, right? Because that was all the Commodores. Yeah. This is way back in the dark ages when there was barely electricity. Well, this tape got eaten by the tape machine. I was so mad. I put the whole thing back in the box and shoved it into my closet, and I didn't program again until I was in college.
That was a crazy thought, but I remember there's the same thing, that Sinclair Spectrum. I remember you, like, when I played games on it all the time, and you put it into your tape deck and hit play, and you wait while it loads the program onto the computer from your cassette player.
Isn't that crazy? Yeah, at least it wasn't punch cards, right?
Yeah, you hear
stories
like
about people with punch cards.
Yeah, well, at least it was relatively convenient to make copies.
Yeah,
because you could just you would just put it into
tape to tape,
you know, hi-fi, and off you go.
Yeah, Yeah, those were the glory days, right?
Yeah, now it's these kids these days.
Kids these days, I tell you. Yeah.
So, so shifting gears again slightly, one thing I was always curious about for someone who's been doing this for a while, and especially from the progression from back in the Mac days, and Xcode as it's progressed in all the different ways, it's how's your debugging process like? And how do you go about when you hit a bug, how do you go about trying to nail it down and find it? Kind of what's your mindset and your approach for that?
So the first thing I do is think through the problem. And what I try to do, and this is something I tell all my students, is apply the scientific method. And that sounds sort of glib or whatever, but so many people don't. They just start randomly sticking log statements in their code and breakpoints and clicking around until they find something that they think is the problem, and they apply a change that they copy from Stack Overflow or who knows where, and they click the go button, and the bug is gone in the path that they expected. And what I find happens, and I'm guilty of doing that too, right?
Sure.
The same thing when I'm in a hurry. What I find when I do that is I've masked the bug. I haven't actually found and fixed the bug. I just changed its behavior. And so now the bug is still there, but I don't see it because the path I've been following is fixed. And so I first try to think through, okay, what's the real problem? And then I start putting things into the code to force that, to test that hypothesis. It's either true or it's false. And if it's not true, then I have to rethink. Or if it's partially true. So, for example, if you expect the box to be pixel aligned that you're drawing with Core Graphics on the screen, and for some reason it's showing up fuzzy, well, then you can go through and say, oh, well, duh, the obvious problem is I'm not rounding my rectangle to integer or half-integer boundaries or whatever, right? So then I go through and I look and see, well, I'm actually doing that. Okay, well, now what's going wrong? So then I would form the next version of the hypothesis to say, okay, well, I must be changing that rectangle somewhere else, right? So then I might put a watch point with LLDB, put a watch on that variable, or whatever like that to sort of track down what's really the problem. And then I try to go as far as I can to prove to myself that that really is the issue before I apply a change.
Mm-hmm.
Then I apply the change and test to make sure that it really did, leaving all that logging or debug statements or whatever that I put in with the debugger and so forth, leaving all that stuff in place until, okay, so the behavior has stopped manifesting itself, but did I actually fix the real problem or did I just mask it? So I try to put enough instrumentation in my code, meaning things like log statements or breakpoints that I turn to continue and put log statements inside the breakpoint, put enough of that stuff in so that when I think I've fixed it and I run, I can see the real issue.
Mm.
Another thing that I found really helpful is if I'm doing something like a networking code or something that is happening in the background and it's happening repeatedly, you're downloading 100K of JSON or whatever, and if you put a breakpoint for every 4K that comes down, you have to continue. That gets so tedious that I just don't do that. So what I do is put in log statements and wrap that in a hash if def debug or something like that so that it would only happen when I have the debug thing on. And then I leave that code in there forever because I find a lot of times I am being an idiot with writing networking code and it just sucks in a whole number of ways. And so I put that instrumentation in there, flip on the switch that turns on the logging, and I watch that logging that comes out to determine if I'm getting it right or if I'm doing something wrong. And I'll put statements like, is this thread the foreground thread? And if it is, and I print out an error message saying, hey, idiot, you're running your networking code on the foreground thread, you're going to hose somebody. And then I always run that with that test flag turned on to print out those logging statements before I declare a branch or a whatever or ship it or, make it beta or whatever, just so that I get some sanity check that all that stuff that I put in is doing the right thing. So those are things where I'm observing bad behavior. Another thing that I try to do every time before I ship something is run instruments against the code and not just like leaks, because a lot of people that I run into run leaks, but I run leaks, the allocation instrument, I run time profiler, I run the core animation instrument and check my frames per second on all my animations and stuff. And I try to do that again before I ship anything off to beta or any other release that anybody else is going to see. And I use the allocations instrument to look at not just am I growing constantly in memory, but how many, I expect that I'm parsing JSON so I have 1,000 strings because there's 1,000 strings coming out of this JSON file. Do I have 12,000 that are transient? Huh. And I scratch my head and start looking at why is that going on. And what I often find is when I do that stuff, I find problems in my code that would have never come up unless I had done that. Because it's not technically a bug. All I'm doing is taking electrons from the battery and increasing entropy in the world, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a bad thing. Yeah. And so those are sort of the big things. I put breakpoints, and I tell the breakpoint to log and auto-continue.
Yeah.
I put breakpoints in and then examine the program at a particular spot in the breakpoint. And then I put logging statements in that are wrapped in some sort of flag that says, do this log or don't do this log. And then use instruments a lot.
Yeah. What you're saying with instruments, it makes me think it's the difference between a program working and it working well.
Mm.
Because it's often, at least I find, it's relatively easy to make something work.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can get the intended result to happen, but the challenge is usually, it's like the difference between I had a college professor who always said there's always a naive implementation and then there's the right implementation. And almost always, it's like you can make something happen, but like you say, and it will work fine. And I mean, I often find this especially, but it's the difference between when you're developing in the simulator,
mm-hmm.
and you can essentially you have infinite speed and infinite memory, and
right.
everything's like your connection's always wonderful, and it works in those circumstances. And then you'll run it on you're doing your compatibility testing. And you'll put it on like an old third gen iPod Touch, and you're just like, oh my goodness,
this is not my code. Who wrote this horrible stuff?
Yeah, this is not going to work. And it's
right.
But it's like instruments is a great way to find those, those kinds of things that it's working.
Yeah.
But, or animations is another one where it's working, but it's at 30 frames a second or whatever. Right. And so you're doing something, or you're being non-optimal in your implementation.
Yeah. And I love that, especially when you flip on, I'm just that kind of person who is, I don't know. It irritates me if I expected 1,000 strings to be allocated and pitched, and there's 12,000. Like, what is, like, that's just wrong. Something's messed up there. And it's the same thing with looking at the VM tracker. Okay, when my app is running and it's in a steady state, I don't want to have more than 12 meg or 14 meg of dirty memory. Period. Like, I just set that as a goal for myself on any app that I ship, because it's one screen full of information, which is probably about 3.5 meg on an iPhone, on an old iPhone, on a new one. It's probably whatever that is, 10 meg, something like that. Mm-hmm. And then a couple of meg for data. And that's it, right? Because the data that displays that stuff on screen should only be a small amount. So, you know, especially if you're using Core Data or whatever to fetch your data, you have no excuse to fetch all the customers in China. And hopefully that's a billion people who've bought your product. But you should never fetch all of that into memory at once.
Sure.
And so, you know, I love looking at that and sort of digging into those problems, and probably would have made a good tester, you know, or one of those QA people who breaks everything. But I like digging into that and finding stuff. It's really fun. One of the things I used to do at Apple that I really loved was helping people who would come in with their apps and say, you know, whatever, this app looks really cool, but it doesn't perform very well. And, you know, you look them in the eye and say, have you run instruments? And you can tell, because some people hesitantly say, yeah. That's the person who ran leaks, 2 weeks after they started the project and not again. Most people say, what's instruments? And so, you know, you sit down with them and you start showing them in their code. You've never looked at their code before, right? I don't even have access to their code. And I look and say, oh, yeah, see here you're doing networking on the main thread. Oh, and see over here, you're allocating 4 million strings and throwing away 4 million strings. What are you even doing? Like, were you dropped off a turnip truck? What are you talking about? Right? I mean, I was never rude to people, but, you know, it's really fun to go look at that stuff. And, oh, look, this animation's running at 15 FPS, and everything is transparent. See all this red? This really shouldn't be here. So it's fun.
I mean, I definitely noticed that every time I've gone to a lab at WWDC, almost always the first, and it doesn't even matter necessarily what the problem is I'm having. I don't think I've ever had a debugging or a work session with one of the people at the WWDC lab that didn't involve launching instruments.
Yeah.
For something.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things though. For the first probably the first year or two of being an iOS developer, I never ran it,
mm-hmm.
ever. Like, it just never, other than, like you say, every now and then running, it's like if I have a leak that I'm trying to track down, it's like, right. Oh, I'll run the leaks tool. That's what it does.
Right.
But it is, it's this, and it's, for me, it's always one of my highlights of the actual sessions at WWDC are, like, the what's new in the developer tools, mm-hmm. instrument stuff. Because it's one of these things, like, the first time you ever see them, all the little, like, the magic checkboxes,
yeah.
is the thing that always, like, blows your mind, where you hit the box, and all of a sudden, everything turns green that's wrong.
Right.
For whatever definition yeah. of wrong is.
Right, right.
Like, I have to do off-screen drawing, so it turns this color, or it's transparent, so it's doing this. And it's just this amazing thing where it's able to show you the problem in a way that almost doesn't seem possible.
Yeah.
That somehow, it's like, how does it know that's where the problem is? And it's like, well, that's...
It's awesome, isn't it?
It's like they wrote the frameworks on the one end and the tools to debug the frameworks, so...
It's so cool. And the power of dtrace, too, right? I mean, yeah. it's like the incremental cost of having that in there and turned off is nil, virtually. It's almost yeah. nothing. And so you can just spread that stuff everywhere and then flip it on like a switch. You could even... I haven't actually done this in any production app, but you could build your own dtrace stuff and stick it in your app, and then you could run it against instruments and see if your app is doing what you expect. But yeah, I love instruments. It's like I tell my students in class, it's like a code spelunking tool.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you see the surface of the mountain, and it's very pretty, but when you go spelunking into that mountain, you see yeah. the guts, you see what's inside of it, and that's what you get out of instruments, is you get to see what's really happening. And we often, within so many different things that we do in life, we have a plan and we start executing it, and so many things distract us from the one path that we had laid out.
Mm.
That's what happens with code, is you start with this plan, this beautiful abstract design that's perfect in your mind, and then real implementation gets in the way, right? And you end up with all this messy junk. If you don't go back and look at it with instruments...
Mm.
You know, I mean, do you remember what you wrote 6 weeks ago? I don't
sure.
even, right? Yesterday, I forget the stuff that I wrote yesterday. So I love instruments as a tool to be able to help you figure that stuff out and see what's really going on.
Yeah.
The OpenGLES tool, I don't know if you got a chance to look at that or if you play much with OpenGL, and I'm by no means an expert. My son is big time into that stuff, but I love the OpenGL expert and the other OpenGLES tools. You can tap one button and it captures the entire frame, all the buffers that you're drawing data into, and shows you them graphically. All the textures that are bound, how they're bound, flip a switch and it will start running your code through an analyzer that basically turns off the fragment stage. Does the performance change? Okay, well then your fragment stage is probably fine. It turns off the vertex stage. Oh, look at that. The performance went up to 60 FPS. I bet your vertex shaders are hosed, right? And so then it points that out to you without you having to go through and tweak all that stuff yourself. It's just, it's amazing. It just blows me away how cool it is.
Yeah, I've only ever seen the OpenGL stuff in, like, WWDC sessions. Yeah, it's one of those things that I've written almost every kind of game and almost every type of app you could imagine, and used almost every framework except things with OpenGL and games. That's the one area that, like, I mean, when I'm talking to a client, or what kind of experience is, like, I can do anything except for games.
Right.
Or anything 3D. I'm an entirely 2D person.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's one of those things I would sorely love to do something. I don't even care if it's a game. I just want to do some OpenGL stuff. I love it. I play with it every time I have free time between books or classes or whatever. I end up spending time doing OpenGL stuff. It's really, really cool.
Cool. And I guess the last thing that I kind of wanted to talk about is just in terms of like lessons you've learned, or perhaps even better, coming from your position as an educator, are what are kind of some of these common mistakes or problems that you see people doing over and over again that would be good things to make sure you never, ever do?
Yeah, so some stuff that I see brand new people to the platform do, and it happens across the board, and I don't know... There's a few people here and there who don't fall into the trap, but most people do. And that's really thinking about what you're doing before you go to do it. We're so trained with Google now that, or whatever search engines, I want to change the background color of a text field. what's the first thing people do? They don't go read the docs or engage their mind. They search on Google, find something on Stack Overflow, and copy and paste it.
Sure.
I'm as guilty as the next person of doing that. But I see people do that, and that's their development approach. And they never get to the point where they actually understand what the background property is on a view. And they don't understand why it might be better to use background property than to use draw rect. They never process that stuff because they're so conditioned to Google, copy paste, done, ship it, kind of stuff. So that's the number one thing I would encourage people to do is please, you know, I understand that needs to happen from time to time, but especially when you're learning, stop that. It's fine if you go Google it and look at it on Stack Overflow, but never copy the code from Stack Overflow. Go read the docs on background property. And then when you get there and you scratch your head and you say, huh, there's a little note at the end. The last phrase in there says, this is more efficient than drawing a background color in DrawRect. What's DrawRect? Go dig into DrawRect. And that sort of find the path to peel back the onion is the most important thing to make you a good, seasoned iOS developer. You know, now that we have Arc and storyboards, I think there's fewer problems that are typical, people always get stuck on. I still have a lot of people who, from Google or I don't know where, but they get this idea that interface builders shouldn't be used and they should write everything in code. And that's another one of my soapbox things where I just stand up and say, look, you know, you got to pull your head out. That's ridiculous. What are you talking about? Because a lot of people read these blog posts that say, oh, Interface Builder is so slow and whatever. Oh, it just makes me crazy. You know, if it's slow today, it's going to be better tomorrow. And if you write all that code, you're going to be saddled with thousands of lines of code that could be easily represented visually. Other stuff that people consistently mess up. Even with Arc, I see people struggling with understanding the memory management. And I think the biggest reason that people struggle is, again, that engaging their mind to not just read the docs, but to build puzzles to understand what's going on with with retain, release, auto-release, whatever, so that they can understand what's really going on there.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, it's always one of those funny things. I always find this with myself. There is all these shortcuts that you can take in development, whether that's just grabbing code on Stack Overflow or tools or techniques that you'll find on a blog post, or all these kind of. I guess I always think about them most as these shortcuts that. But it's almost like you have to have a driver's license before you can use those.
I like that analogy.
Because if you're sitting there, it's sort of like when you're learning to drive. It's at least with me, it's when I was learning to drive, it's two hands on the wheel at whatever it is. It's at 9 and 3 or 2 and 10 or whatever you're supposed to do. And all of these things that are important for helping you really grasp and have a solid command of the skill that you can ease up on once you're proficient in that task and in that skill. And I find that myself. It's there's all these things that you get into trouble when you start doing things that anytime you have code in your app that you don't understand.
Yes.
Is probably even the simplest way. When I think of that situation you're describing, that I've certainly seen in my consulting days a lot, where you see this code and it's what does this do? It's I don't know.
I got that from Stack Overflow.
And you're it seemed to work when I put it in.
Right.
And it's this problem of, I'm finding the little nugget from Stack Overflow or from someone's blog or something, hopefully what it is I'm seeing something and saying, oh, right, that's how you do it.
Right.
It's helping draw that connection between two frameworks or that I'm not familiar with, or helping me find the bug in my code where it's oh, that's right. Anytime you use this class, you have to also do this thing, or all these little either undocumented or poorly documented little tricks that you have to do to make things work great. And if you start throwing too many of those in that you don't understand, then you're debugging becomes impossible.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because what's that, the old saying? Don't write code don't write code that's too smart, because debugging is harder than writing code.
Right.
And so if you write code that's at your limit of intellect, You'll never be able to debug it because debugging's harder. So by definition, it's impossible to debug code that's at your limit of intellect. It's like write code that's easy and understandable, and then you can actually debug it.
Right.
And work on it. So yeah, I certainly see those types of things.
Yeah, I find a lot of times, and I've been joking about this recently on Twitter, is that I look back at everything I wrote 6 months ago or even 6 weeks ago and think, who's the idiot who wrote this code? Yeah. And you know, on the one hand, I think that's positive because you're always learning new stuff and you're always learning new ways to approach things or think about things or whatever. Where I see people fall down, though, is that they buy into that and they say, oh, 6 weeks ago I was dumb or 6 months ago or whatever. But then they never like go the next step of, oh, I'm going to figure out why that works the way that it does or whatever. So, yeah. It's an important thing. I think it's too easily overlooked with the ability to make progress on whatever it is, the feature you're trying to implement or the app you're trying to get shipped or whatever, to just copy and paste from someone else.
Oh, sure. And all the little lies we tell ourselves of, oh, I'll fix it as soon as I ship.
Right. Yeah.
As soon as that...
1.1 will have that fixed.
Yeah, I'll totally fix that and I won't be cheating on that. But that never seems to happen.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. Well, I wanted to thank you for taking the time to
be here
on the show this week. And before you go, though, I wanted to sort of give you an opportunity to sort of talk about how people can find you, follow you online, those types of things, and projects and things you have upcoming that you should
know about. Yeah, that's awesome. So the Pragmatic Programmer's book on the iOS SDK has been fully updated to iOS 6. We did a beta cut right before we started putting iOS 6 content in there. So the iOS, or the book that's currently shipping covers iOS 5, where it's updated for iOS 6, and then as soon as it goes public, we'll ship a beta version that goes public, and then it'll go off to the printers and be a couple weeks after that before the paper hits, which I'm really looking forward to. It was a fun book to write, and it was really cool to sort of go in and rethink the way we wrote the book the first time. So it's a very different, completely rewritten book. So that was a lot of fun. I'm also working on a book that I'm self-publishing through the iBook Store on C, the language, and all the stuff that, as a proficient Objective-C programmer, that you've looked at and thought, what is that pointer thing? I'll just pass nil for the error because I don't really understand ampersand error. Stuff like that to sort of help you understand what does that ampersand thing really mean? What are pointers and stuff? And it's kind of, some people look at me like I'm kind of nuts, but I'm basically going to take you from the type system of C and understanding the basic types and then how they sort of evolved into objects, how we ended up with Objective-C objects by talking about structs, and then we're going to implement a really simple version of the Objective-C runtime so you can send messages to the struct that you built, which is kind of, on the one hand, sort of nutty and very nerdy and behind the scenes kind of, you'll only enjoy this book, I think, if you like to understand how things really work. But on the flip side, I think it's also going to help a lot of people who are proficient at Objective-C but want to take their development to that next level to understand stuff more deeply or whatever. So that will be, it'll definitely be done by the end of the year. I'm working on a lot of really fun HTML5 CSS interactives to sort of show off the code and help people understand how stuff works. So that will be by the end of the year, roughly. And then I'm also, speaking of teaching kids, I'm working on a series of books to help kids understand how to program games on the iPhone. And so that'll be like very basic programming all the way up to, doing game type stuff. So I eventually, my goal is to make it all the way to OpenGL. So you get basic programming all the way to loading an OBJ file or a Collada file and displaying it on screen and having your bad guys shoot guns at each other. But that's probably a 2-year effort to get all that stuff written. So, you know, it's also a sort of a background thing. So that's the two big things that I'm doing that are sort of personal, and then still doing a little bit of consulting here and there, and doing a lot of teaching.
If people want to find you online,
So I'm B. Dudney on Twitter, so you can follow me there. I have a blog at bill.dudney.net, which I've been a slacker and haven't been updating nearly as much as I would like to, but those are the two big places where I do most of my my public stuff. So
great. Once again, I just wanted to thank you for taking the time, and I really appreciate you talking.
Sure, it was a blast. It was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Great, thanks.